And this is the introduction to the recording. My name is Tom Edwards. Today's date is February 29th, 1912, and I'm interviewing for the first time...
2012.
I'm sorry. 2012. I'm interviewing for the first time Lee Downs and Marietta Downs. The interview is taking place at, what's your address here?
389 4th Avenue.
389 4th Avenue in Columbia Falls. The interview is sponsored by the North Fork Landowners Association and is part of the History Project. So then, Lee, the first question I have for you is, where were you born and when were you born?
I was born in 1928, about four blocks from here.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're a Montana native.
I'm a real native.
Marietta, how about you?
Born in 1936 at Mason City, Washington, now known where the Columbia Dam is.
Okay. So the city's gone, right? Underwater?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So if you were born in Columbia Falls, you've been up to North Fork all your life.
That's right. My granddad and my mother homesteaded just north of Columbia Falls. They're about 3 miles from here.
3 miles. Okay.
Yeah. And when I was a boy, I used to herd my grandfather's cattle up along the North Fork Road for pasture. After the 29 fire, he didn't have as much.
Right.
You know, and I did that a lot. And actually, the North Fork Road goes in about the same direction, but from Columbia Falls to Big Creek, it's not in the same locations that it was. It just touches on where it was. And when the North Forkers, they would start north from Columbia Falls, they used Cedar Creek, it's Crystal Creek now. But they would, for reference, they'd have First Cedar, Second Cedar, Third Cedar. It was bridges across the creek.
Sure.
And when you got up there to about 3 miles north, you could go over Parker Hill. It was a J. Neal's Road that was built. And in the spring of the year, some of the guys would go that. It was a little bit drier than down in the bottom where the road is now. And they just went that way. They just used the, you know, for reference, they'd say, well, it's Second Cedar and such, you know.
So was it a trail that just kind of grew into a road as people used it in the beginning that you remember?
Yeah, it wasn't. It wasn't plowed until in the late 40s they started plowing it a little bit. But before that it wasn't plowed. Yeah, we lived out there by the aluminum plant. And the county, the road that would be drifted shut, and it sometimes would be a week before the county got it open. I can remember one time my dad and my granddad was in a wagon. It must have been about 32. We was going right at First Cedar Creek. We was in a wagon, and the water was up to the box on the wagon. Cedar Creek was, you know, there was nothing to hold it back. It had just been burned, the whole country, and it just water all over.
So the water would have been up to the horse's belly? You had horses at that point?
Oh, it was right up to the wagon box.
Yeah. So how did the
horse... Well, I wanted to get the edge of the wagon box and look out, and... They wouldn't let me. They made me sit in the middle of the wagon.
Sure. Did you know how to swim then?
Pardon?
Did you know how to swim?
No.
Okay.
I was still wearing three-quarter pants.
He's never learned how to swim.
Yeah, and in the early days at Second Cedar, during fire season, the Forest Service had a camp there. It wasn't a camp, it was just a resident Forest Service guy. Anybody come down the road had to stop going up to North Fork, and they had to have an axe, shovel, and bucket. And they had to be in good condition or they couldn't go. They just wouldn't let them go. They just had to turn around and go get the stuff or whatever.
So let me ask you this question. This is jumping ahead a little bit, but how old were you when you actually moved up the North Fork to the location that those of us today would know as your place?
Well, when I got out of the service, I bought a place up there in 1953. That was my mustering out pay out of the Army. And that was Cyclone Parks. You could go there in the fall of the year, you know, in November, and there was deer all over. You could just sit there and pick out the one you wanted. But it's changed. The wolves have, they've just about eliminated the game on Coal Creek. There's no moose left to speak of. I've seen two moose all in a year, and I think it was the same moose.
That could be.
Yeah.
That could well be.
Yeah. Yeah, they had Fool End Hill used to have dry bridges on it. There was three dry bridges, and it was quite a deal. And it was always sliding in. And I can remember it must have been about 55 or 56 it was. And I come to one morning and there was 10 feet of dirt in the road, and the ranger was on top of there. And he says, "Well, where are you going?" And I said, "I was going up to do some erosion work." And he thought a minute and he says, "I'll tell you what." He says, "You take my pickup and go to work, and I'll take your pickup and go to town." He says, "I got to go to town." So I traded him pickups right there, and I come there that night at about 5:30, 6 o'clock, and there was a ranger standing on top. And he says, "You're going to be here in the morning." Well, I says, "I got to get away to work." And he says, "There's a pickup on the other side." He says, "You use it." That was Bud Powell.
All right. Well, that's one way to make it.
Yeah, he wound up to be supervisor over in Idaho.
So a wood bridge, was that to hold the road onto the hill?
What's that?
The wood bridge that you mentioned, was that to hold the road kind of on the hill?
Yeah, the it was so steep that any dirt they put out went clean to the river.
Yeah. Interesting that you called it a wood bridge. I thought I understood what you were talking about.
Yeah, they had two dry bridges. That was one of the road marks, yeah. Dry bridges, you know. And,
yeah.
And just before you get there, there was a logging camp. Tom Lee and Jim Evern had a log, and they put logs up there all winter, and then they dumped them in the river there over by the chute there at the rapids there at Fool Hen, and floated to Summers. They sold the logs at Summers.
Oh, so that was the way of getting them
That was the farthest the North Fork was ever drove.
I'll be darned.
But from Coram down and then through that area there, they had quite a few log drives in that area.
Right. So in 53 you bought your place, you said?
Yeah.
And did you build a place, did you build up there then right away and move up there?
Yeah, I think I built in 55. Yeah. Yeah, the Forest Service thought they owned that place. They had a cabin there. And the guy that bought the place, he said, wanted to ask the Forest Service whose cabin that was, and they said, "It's ours." And he says, "Well, I own the place." He said, I was just wondering, you know. And then he says, no, you don't own it." And they went and checked, and they found out they didn't own it. And it stayed there till 48, and then they moved it out. They moved it up the creek, and they used it for a scaler shack for a couple of years, and then they moved it to Ford. And then they said that they was going to get rid of all that building, and I asked if I could buy it. And then about 10 years later, they gave it to me. That building.
Took them that long to decide, huh?
Yeah. It took a long time, but I finally got it back.
So then did you have, other than surviving, did you have a real job? I said real job. What was your job?
My job?
For making pay, money, groceries.
I logged in the woods pretty much, salvage logged, and then I contracted to the Forest Service piling brush and whatever, things like that. And then I got a lot of erosion jobs, you know, go out and fix erosion jobs on different places.
So let's clarify what an erosion job was. Were you working on the river or a creek or a road or some of us don't know what an erosion job would have been back then.
I've been in every drainage of the South Fork, Middle Fork, North Fork, you know, working for the Forest Service, I had a cat and a truck, and I could stop and do a job and move. Sometimes I moved 6 or 7 times a day, you know, do different places and do little jobs for them, things like that.
And the erosion work involved what?
Huh?
Your erosion works for them.
Well,
involved what?
They'd have a ditch plugged where somebody had been getting wood or whatever, and I would do that. And then sometimes just, you know, be washouts in the spring, and you go around to do all that repair work.
So were you a contract employee or a regular employee?
I was a contract employee.
Did you ever go regular for the Forest Service?
What's that?
Did you ever be full-time or part-time Forest Service employee?
No, just part-time on fires, uh-huh. Things like that.
Okay.
And I remember one time I was going to work and we spotted a fire. We went down, and me and Bud Ferrick, and done a bunch of handwork and got it stopped. And then a Forest Service guy came by, and we told him there was still fire there. And Pete Darling was working for the Forest Service. And anyway, he come up, and I showed him where the fire was. And guess what? A week later, here it was, I got a check for fighting fire. That's how long I'd been there. And they was really good, them old Forest Service employees.
Well, that sounds pretty fair. Yeah.
They was real fair years ago. Yeah, you do a good job, and you didn't have to look for a job. They just come and get you every year. I'd sign a contract for 5 or 6 years in advance of what I was going to get paid.
Sure.
And that's the way it went. Then I'd done a lot of salvage logging. And then they had, they logged in square blocks up the South Fork. And they didn't think it looked good, so they'd go along and feather them out, you know, you go on the edge and go back in. I've done a lot of that type of logging and brush piling and stuff.
So did you have to pay stumpage for that, or was that?
Yeah, you had to pay stumpage. It was usually, sometimes it was a pretty good deal. Sometimes you got it for $2 or $3 a thousand, and you could afford to come in, and right. If there's a couple loads of logs, you could come out on it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had it all figured out, you know, what it could cost you and what you should make, and they was real fair.
One of the things that my dad, who's a graduate forester from Missoula, always told me, and I've since begun to wonder if he was misinformed or lying to me. He said, well, they practice sustained yield so that they can continue to log forever. Being you were a logger, did you see where they were trying to make the forest last forever?
Yes, but they had the Forest Service had a lot of bad things. They had the spruce bark beetles, yeah. And they come in and they would just take the trees out, and it didn't really work. So they'd just go in and take big blocks of trees out, and then the bugs would still continue in the other timber. You know, only take like Red Meadow and Canyon Creek and Big Creek, you know, it wound up with just huge clear cuts. Well, it really wasn't their fault. They were just trying to manage the timber. It was the thing to do. Mm-hmm. Because if you'd left it go, there was drainage where they left it go, you couldn't even walk in them after, you know, with the down timber and stuff. Right. Spruce doesn't last very long, you know, 6 or 7 years, and it's all on the ground if you don't log it.
Well, and they can kind of gauge that against some of the Park Service land, too.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, in places there, it's piled up 10 feet high like pickup sticks.
Well, yeah, then they got it in the lodgepole. I got a pine beetle in that, and the park was over there, and they didn't log, and it just took the whole North Fork. Just really hard to manage something like that.
Across the river from you, Sullivan's Meadows, I'm sure you're familiar with that place.
Sullivan?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And at one point they logged some property, private property, in the park. Were you familiar with that? Because you can see it from outside.
The Johnson boys logged that, and they're good friends of mine.
Uh-huh.
And they the park had really a lot of restrictions. They couldn't haul lumber out until after 5 o'clock at night and things like that.
Right.
Yeah, they made it as difficult as possible. In fact, the Cummings place, they wanted to log that. They had to take logs out of there. They had to take some timber off the park to make so they could make the corners with a logging truck, and the park wouldn't cooperate at all. And so all that timber went to waste.
Okay.
I was offered a logging job if I could get it out of there. But there was no way you could do it with the park with the restrictions they had.
Do you know or did you work with any horse loggers in your day?
Yes, I even done some.
Did you?
My dad and my granddad were horse loggers.
And how did you like that? What did you think of it?
Well, it was a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
It was a lot of really hard work, and you had to have good horses, well trained. Yeah.
Was that kind of logging light on the land? Was that?
Well, yeah. You'd get out there and you come back in later years and log where they horse logged. And if the trees were real big, they left them because they were too difficult to skid with horses. And so they left them unless they had wooden arches and stuff, you know, to handle the big logs. But that stuff was expensive, and most of the guys that couldn't afford it.
Let's get back outside the park. So talk to me about Polebridge. The town of Polebridge, or the community of Polebridge.
Yeah, there wasn't much there in the early days. The store was there, and that was about it. And where Polebridge is, all the lots are, was a big hay meadow.
I know that.
Yeah.
I hayed that for Ted Ross.
It was just
one
a big
summer.
Hay meadow.
Yes.
And the elk used to come there in the spring, and the deer. And of course, that's gone now. But if you had a hay field and had any type of clover alfalfa in it, they would eat it down till you couldn't get a crop off them. They just ate it, just stayed there till it was gone.
And that was constant, always that way?
Pretty much. And I understand that the sage that's up there on Big Prairie and that in there, they were short of hay one winter, and they brought in hay from the east side. From the prairie over there, they just cut prairie hay and brought it in, and it had the sage in it, and that's where the sage come from.
Really? I never knew that. Yeah. I wondered why it was there.
That's what they tell me.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, it isn't anywhere else around the North Fork, is
yeah.
it?
Yeah, they tell a story. Mike Burns told me the story about Johnny Walsh, and I can't remember the other guy yet. But anyway, they were short of groceries this spring, and it was a big job to cut that inside road out to go get groceries.
Yeah.
And anyway, each one was waiting for the other one to go to cut the road out, and Johnny Wall started out first. So he went down the road, and he'd cut them trees out and go through with his wagon. Then he'd unhook the wagon, horses, and drag the log back in the road.
Oh, no.
He'd done that all the way to Belton. It used to be Belton instead of West Glacier.
Oh yeah, I know. I traveled that road when I was 8 years old because my dad was a seasonal ranger, so we would come back from our Lou days in town and drive up there, and he always planned it so that he would hit Dutch Creek, I think was the edge of the boundary for the logging station. So at 8 o'clock in the morning, we would be just past Dutch Creek, and he could be on the job and call the patrol to get home because my grandmother lived in Kalispell. So we would go to town and spend 2 days in town with her and then come home early in the morning of probably it was Friday morning. I think our Lou days were Wednesday and Thursday off. So, and we always had to cut trees on that road, or we would go to McFarland's for a square dance, and a wind would come up, and you'd end up with 6 trees in the road between Polebridge and logging. That's 7 miles you'd have to cut before you could get home.
That was the only way into the North Fork for a long time. In fact, the county used to plow that road so the mail could be brought up.
How far up did they plow it?
Just to Polebridge.
Just to Polebridge.
Yeah. Yeah. See, there was a lot of county roads in the park, and I didn't know if they reverted to the park or not. But years ago, there was a lot of roads, even up to Cross Big Prairie in there was a county road.
Well, that's when they forded the rivers. They didn't always use a bridge to get across.
Yeah.
And the post office.
There were several crossings. There was one there at Quartz Creek where they come across into the Home Ranch bottom. And then there was one up there just above Pole Bridge there on the Henson place back in there where they crossed in there. Yeah, they'd cross with them old Model Ts and go across the river.
That'd have to be pretty late in the year, though, only in the fall that they would get away with that?
Well, I suppose after high water, then they could cross.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, just there at Hay Creek, before that fire, there was a poplar tree there that had names and dates on it, 1915 and stuff, but it burned up in the fire.
Right.
It's a pretty historic tree, really.
Have you ever stopped and looked at the cottonwoods and the aspen trees on the sides of the North Fork Road? It's almost like a billboard. If you're walking or hiking and you go down the road in a car, you don't see it. But people have put a date or their initial or something, and it makes you wonder why is that there? But it's interesting because they're all along the road if you take the time to get out and look, particularly up far north where the road hasn't been pushed out.
Yeah, on the old North Fork Road there on the Home Ranch bottoms, there was a poplar tree there that had Johnny Hossick name on it. He was a young fellow that Ralph Flair pretty much raised. And he wound up to be a supervisor, too, in the Forest Service. He got pretty high up. And that tree, I've got it in the basement of my house up there. I cut it off and put it in there, but since the bark has fell off and stuff and lost the name, but it was quite a deal.
Did you use it?
When you went over Fulham, right there, there's that big hole on the left, that's called the Devil's Pot.
Okay.
It used to have that name on the maps even.
Right.
And the road went just on the north side and then side hilled all the way into the bottom of Big Creek, or Hell Roaring Creek. At Hell Roaring Creek, there used to be a big patch of cedar trees. And that was, in the early days, Mike Burns, he located the road from Junkett's Corner to Coal Creek. And that was in 1915, I think it was.
So I don't know Junkett's Corner. Where is that?
That's Blankenship's now.
Okay.
Yeah, see that there was Oscar Junkett's homestead, and they called that Junkett's Corner.
Okay.
Yeah, and he was an early homesteader up that way.
So you bring up an interesting point. Have a lot of the names changed in the North Fork? And were the names a lot of times because of the people? Like Sullivan's Meadows, named for whoever homesteaded there. So have you seen a lot of change in that respect?
Yes, I noticed, like the Devil's Pot and Fulham and stuff like that. That was named by Walsh, Mr. Walsh. He named Fulham, Hell Roaring Creek, Rabbit Hill. There's a lot of the names have disappeared over the years. The Rabbit Hill is right just across Coal Creek, and the Beaver Pond's on the right there. That's Rabbit Hill.
Will those Beaver Ponds ever present a problem to the road, or have they in the past?
Yeah, the river run right there for a while. It would wash the road out, and then in 47 they built the road up over the hill and around it, and then they finally got enough money to rebuild it down below and put it down below again. But for about 10 years the road went around that particular spot.
What do you think they'll do with Wirtz Hill? Do you think they'll ever do anything with it?
That was named after Wirtz.
Right.
Yeah, and he homesteaded there in the early days. I think they've got the history on that, pretty much.
His grandson put together a book on the Wirtz place. But I was worried, the similar deal with the road, at some point they may have to move that road.
Yeah.
Because that hill keeps.
Yeah, keeps slumping.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's been a lot of changes in the North Fork. Actually, you know, from Cumbria Calls to Cold Creek, the road is, it just crosses the spots where it has been. It's not in the, it's not the same. Well, from Fool End Hill to Deep Creek, in there it was on the side hill, and then it come down on the bottom, and the road was outsloped, and it was dangerous to drive in the winter time, especially with a two-wheel drive outfit. You always wanted to crowd you off the road.
How long was it before you got a four-wheel drive outfit?
1959.
You got one then, huh?
Yeah.
Were you glad to have it? I bet you were.
Yeah, I seen one and I just figured that was a lot better than putting chains on all the time. It really was handy.
So you mentioned that it's cheaper to live in up the North Fork than in town.
Yes, not only cheaper, but you only depend on what you have put away for survival. And I could have lived up there for 6 months at a time on what I kept in my house from canning.
I'm gonna let the kid came in, I'm gonna shut the door.
It's 10 minutes to the store.
Well, I didn't, you weren't in here. I thought
I just got it.
All by himself.
A cookie.
I love what?
Cookie, Dad. It's the kind you like.
Where'd you get it?
I ran to the store and got you some cookies while I baked the other ones.
Oh.
Yeah, up there we have.
I had a hard time with Ma. She'd go downtown and she'd buy 3 loaves of bread. And I explained to her, you don't have to buy 3 loaves at a time. I says, I want fresh bread. If we buy one loaf at a time, I says, it's only 10 minutes to the store here. But we finally got it all figured out.
I'll just put them.
Cooper's not going to let you put them anywhere.
I know.
Don't set them down.
All right, I'll just give you a couple for in your pocket.
I'll just take one more.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm fine, Carrie.
See, you missed.
Cooper, come here.
So you brought up an interesting point, though, and I don't want to let this get away. To live up the North Fork, it takes the two of you.
Yes.
But you don't have to pay a light bill, let's say, but you do because you have to have lights.
We have a generator.
And you don't have to pay a water bill, but you have to pump it out of the ground or off the spring.
We'd get up when it was daylight and go to bed when it was dark.
That was North Fork hours. Now, pretty near the whole North Fork was running that way, except for the real young people who like to hoot and holler all night. But down here, it's too fast. You push buttons, you depend on everything here, and you don't have that feeling of safety and survival that we had in the North Fork. You know, you knew you could take care of you. I could take care of a couple of my neighbors real easy up there because I canned all the time. Down here, I'm lost.
So did you have a big root cellar in your place?
We had a root cellar. We didn't use it much. We had a basement. We used the stuff mostly in the basement. When the generator was running that day, you washed your clothes, you vacuumed the floor. Everything you did, you baked that day. Everything was done that day. And then we were good till the next time we needed to, which would be about once a week. So, and you get kind of almost frugal on what you have up there because you didn't want to burn it all up because you didn't know when the next load of fuel would come up or propane.
Yep.
But down here, if the electricity goes off, we have nothing.
You know, you have
the wood stove.
You have heat.
Have the wood stove. And we still have him splitting wood.
Yeah, but we depend on electricity for it. It's got a fan.
Fan, yeah.
It's a different way of living. It's nicer because that was about the only thing of the North Fork I didn't like was North Fork Road. Although at one point I loved it. I could have kissed every mile of it getting to our house because we went back to Washington, D.C. in 84 to see our son. When we saw that North Fork Road, I could have kissed it all the way home. I don't like traffic.
You knew you were home. Felt good, yeah.
No, I could go up there. Well, that one winter, I didn't get out until April.
Let me ask you this question. Because you lived on the North Fork Road, and you guys didn't have pavement in front of your house. But I always remember, and to this day, appreciate the smell of the dust. I mean, it's a pain, it's a nuisance, but it's like you say, it's like being home when you recognize that.
It was pretty continual up there.
Well,
you could open the front window, and in an hour's time, you could write your name on all across the table on all the furniture. There was so much road dust, and then mostly it was tourists, people coming to look. It's
well,
a great
that,
place.
That place we had up there was homesteaded by Joe McNamee. I don't know, he was in the teens when he homesteaded. But he left there in 1922 because there was too damn many people.
Really? Where'd he go?
Alaska.
Did he?
I never heard of him again.
Down?
Huh?
He was about ready to borrow your cookie.
He knows I share.
So who homesteaded, to me it's called the Ladenburg place. Did you ever know those people?
Mike homesteaded, and then he hired other guys to homestead, and he'd buy their homestead for $100 or $200, and he had like 900 acres there.
So that was actually homesteaded by the Ladenburgs?
Burns.
Mike Burns.
Burns, okay.
Mike Burns, yeah. He was there. There was quite an activity for coal. And up Coal Creek, about a mile, there's a shaft back in the hill. Quinn it was. And anyway, Patrick Walsh, the senior, Dick's dad, and Pat's granddad, was one of the guys in there. They made rafts and floated it down to Coal Creek. I had a big raft there, and it was floated to Columbia Falls for the Talbot Building. And he wanted to burn coal, so that's where they got the coal.
Floated it all the way down the river, too?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That must have been quite an adventure.
Yeah. Well, Steamer Oaks, I drug the paddle wheel out, me and Bob Hurd, for the Forest Service. He's sitting down at the bridge down there, and they got a sign there. Anyway, I got elevated to a ranger on that sign.
That wasn't why I asked you if you ever worked for the Forest Service, but it ties right in, doesn't
it? There's always a little bit of blood there.
Yeah, I had a contract when it was an open contract. Whenever they had some work, they did get me.
They knew that usually if they got Lee, he'd go right then. He wouldn't say tomorrow or the next day.
So did you have a pretty big garden at your place?
We had a nice garden.
And did you garden every year, or did you do carrots one year and potatoes the next year? How did that work?
We planted potatoes, carrots, turnips, cabbage, peas. What else did we do?
Well, beans and stuff like that was iffy because
frost.
A lot of years you get a frost every month, you know.
Right.
Stuff that... Carrots and cabbage, they're pretty frost resistant. You could raise them. But a lot of the guys up there had greenhouses, small greenhouses, and they'd grow gardens.
So what's the earliest greenhouse that you remember somebody having?
Well, I didn't even know the people, but I was doing work up there at Trail Creek and on different homesteads that finally reverted to the Forest Service and stuff, and there would be greenhouses there.
Tell him about the time we grew the 51 cauliflowers.
The what?
The cauliflower plants that we grew. the 51 of them, and remember the Kikamini cattle?
Oh.
We went to town to buy stuff. The cauliflower were all ready to harvest. So we went to town to get some vinegar and stuff. We were going to pickle a bunch of them. We come home, we didn't get enough to fill a gallon jar. The cattle came in and ate them all.
Yeah.
Tom comes down, and we really were mad and upset, and we were telling him. He said, well, it wasn't his cattle. He knew for positive it wasn't his cattle. Well, how do you know? He said, I smelled each one's breath. They didn't have cauliflower on the breath. So a few weeks later, Charlie Ritter, who was a neighbor of ours and up from Ladenburg's, he came down with a rib cage. He'd bought a half of beef and had taken everything off of it, and he brought it down so he could use it for bait for coyotes and stuff. Lee hung it on the fence. And everybody thought we had a cult going out there because he'd hang that out there and Tom would hang the coyotes on the fence. And the first time
Tom the girls made a sign, remember?
Yeah.
It says, cows beware. And they hung it there with the rib cage. Tom got quite a kick out of that, you know. Everybody thought we was having a big feud, but we wasn't.
Well, there were, back when, with open range and when the cows were there in the summer,
yeah.
Many, many people had their yards trashed by the cows, and they weren't happy with it.
No.
You know, I mean, I think everybody...
It's open range, and if you don't want them, you got to fence them out.
Right.
And I think a few of the locals up there ate a few, you know, because it gets doggone mad at losing their gardens, and they just...
I know that to be a fact.
Yeah.
I do.
We do too, but we try to be nice about it.
But having said that, the incident that I know about, it wasn't eaten by the people, it was eaten by a grizzly bear.
Uh-oh.
But the bear had a little help getting the cow.
Well, years ago when Finley Arnett was up there, he had a cow that was lame, and it couldn't stand the drives of Columbia Falls, so he was going to haul it. And he left a couple of other cows there with it. And anyway, when we went to get it, a grizzly bear had come in and killed one cow, and he turned it into the fish and game. And Lorne Deese and Ross Wilson went up, and he killed another cow, and they finally killed the bear. They'd done it, but that's the only really grizzly bear getting cattle up there that I know of.
The one other story that I heard of, and you probably heard of it too, was when Ted Ross was at the store, he had horses that he rented to dudes, and he also rented them to the Border Patrol for their annual ride down the border. But one winter, the story that I recollect was that a grizzly bear, got into the barn area and chewed up a corral and chewed up a horse, and I remembered seeing one horse that had a big stitch on her hip, and the story I was told that it was part of that bear attack, but that was only hearsay. So,
well, Huli Stein used to have a place up there, the big meadow just across the Hay Creek, and his corral was made with three logs. There were two logs laying on the ground and one rolled in the middle, and that was his corral.
Was it very tall?
Yeah, that kept the horses in. They were big logs.
Yeah, so they could have been 4 feet high or 5 feet tall.
Yeah.
Big logs.
Yeah, there's a story that Ralph there told me about Huli Stein, and he used to make a little whiskey, and he sell it. And anyway, the 4th of July, everybody got oiled up, and Huli passed out. And Ralph Thayer Frank Newton. Anyway, they took and tied his pant cuffs with a bale twine, and then stuffed his pants plumb full of horse manure. When he was passed out, he woke up and he wore a pair of army pants that was about two sizes too big, and they had that just bump full of horse manure and left him there. imagine that would be quite a surprise waking up like that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm surprised he didn't retaliate, get back at him. He probably did at some point.
I imagine payback for hell. I never heard what the payback for it.
Would you tell him the story you told me about the cook in the CC camp here in the North Fork that his bread dough fell on the floor?
Oh, that was a Forest Service cook at Big Creek. But he was from down south, and Ralph there and them old guys, they knew he was scared of bears. And so they had the garbage can just sitting outside the cook shack, and anyway, they took some ketchup and spread it around out there and fired a couple shots and told him the bear was there. And anyway, the joke wound up on them. The guy says, to hell with it. He packed up and left. He wouldn't come back. They tried to tell him they was cheap jobbing him. He says, I don't give a damn. There's too many bears. And he left.
I was referring to the story you told me about the CC camp that had the pigs and the cook, and the cook spilled the bread dough on the floor.
Yeah, that was down in the Swan where that happened.
I thought that was
It wasn't up the North Fork.
But anyway,
he was packing the dough to mix it, and he fell on the floor and dropped it. And so they took it out and fed it to pigs, and it killed the pigs. They swelled up, and anyway, they took them out to the dump, and the bear come along and ate the pigs and ate that dough, and the bear killed the bear too.
Quite an epidemic. So one action led to a whole bunch of others.
So yeah, don't even trust the bread dough. My grandpa said that really happened up there in Canada, where he came from. That the missus was mixing up bread up there in the little soddy, and she had two kids, and they were watching, and they were hungry, and they asked for bread dough. She gave me a chunk of bread dough, and then she had to go outside to get some water or something. But you come back in, they got into more bread dough, and they got horribly sick, screaming, and she didn't know what was wrong.
Sure.
Hooked the teams together and worked. It's a long ways to a doctor, and they were going to head for the nearest neighbor. By the time they got there, their little kids were dead. It was from bread dough.
I'll be darned. I never heard that. And we bake bread and stuff. I just never thought of eating raw dough, or rising dough, I guess is a better description.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
A lot of different things from a lot of different people. Should have been put in books years ago.
Yeah, them old cars that they had years ago, though, they had real high tire, narrow tires and high, they'd go through a tremendous amount of snow. They'd go through more snow than a lot of these four-wheel drives will go through today.
Well, because they were taller.
Yeah, they were so high and made such a narrow track.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, Ralph there told about in January driving up to Trail Creek. And, he told about in the early days, Ralph there told me that he said in the middle of the night you hear a lot of whooping and a hollering, and the Indians would go by with 60, 70 horses that they stole on the east side. And he said a month later they'd be whooping and a hollering, and Indians driving them back. They'd steal them from each other, just back and forth all the time.
So what year would you suspect that occurred
in? That was early 1900s.
Early 1900s.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that was going, I mean.
Well, you got to get a hold of Howard Green, because he tells about going up Trail Creek with Ralph Thayer, and I can't remember who the other guy was. But anyway, when they got up there, he showed them Indian graves up there, and it's in the Timothy Meadows area up there.
Sure.
But Howard went back years later, and he said they'd changed so much since the road had put in and they logged that he couldn't even identify the spot where they were. It had changed that much over the years.
Yeah, things do change, and they change in about 10-year chunks. I'm sure you can remember things that you remember one way, and 10, 15 years later, it was different, and you never imagined that would be the case.
Yeah, it changes tremendously.
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to imagine just looking at these construction places, how a home will go up, or a hospital or something. It's just almost overnight.
Exactly.
See, a grizzly bear got Ralph Thayer in 1928, I think it was, up Canyon Creek, and crippled him up pretty good. Ralph told me the story of what happened. He sat down on a log and he had his pack and his axer with him. He's locating trails. And anyway, a bear grabbed him when he was eating lunch, and he said, I had sense enough to grab my axe, and he chopped over his shoulder, and he says, I got a pretty good lick in, and she turned him loose.
I'll be darned.
And he walked from there to the North Fork Road with a broken leg. He made a crutch and made it out. And he says, there wasn't many cars that day, and them years, and he says, just as luck would have it, he said, a car come by just as he got to the road.
Amazing.
And then there was an old doctor by the name of Burns. He was an old-time doctor here. And anyway, he asked Ralph, he says, well, he says, I'd give a chloroform or Old Crow. And he says, give me the Old Crow. And he said, he's like...
Did you ever have any personal encounters with a bear?
Oh, yeah.
How did that happen?
Somebody killed an elk right close to my camp in there, and I got up the next morning and it was snowing, there was about a foot of new snow, and a guy walked right by there, and I said, well, they're going after the elk. It quit snowing about 10 o'clock, and I said, well, I'm going to go see where they're going. I went out there, and there they come to the elk, and I could see where they hooked onto it and was dragging it. And, of course, it was snowed in. You couldn't see much. And I said, well, Jiminy Christmas, the damn fools are dragging it the wrong way. And so I got on their trail, and I was going to catch them, and I got out there, and there was a grizzly bear. And it was a thick lodgepole like that, and he drug it around, and there was a little point, and he was on the other side. And I looked, and there just as soon as I made eye contact with that bear, he come. And he tried to come through that lodgepole, and it was so thick he couldn't get through, and he had to get on the trail where he drugged the elk. And anyway, when he come around the corner, he was probably 30, 40 feet from me. I says, well, I might as well shoot him, you know, so I shot him. And he didn't, after that he forgot all about me. He stood on his hind legs and started grabbing them lodge poles, and they were 1.5 to 2 inches, and he'd bite one off, pull another one over and bite it off and roar it all the time. And then he fell over on his back dead.
Yeah. So the guys got run off by the bear, or this the bear was dragging their elk the wrong way?
The bear was on the elk, it wasn't a man, it was a bear that walked by. Right by.
Oh, I see.
But it had enough snow that I couldn't really tell,
sure.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of bears. Ted Ross killed a bear in there by my elk by my cabin, and he went to get it, and he went up there where it was. He left it overnight, and the next morning the bears had it. It was gone.
And that's still some concern today. One of the kids that lives up Moose Creek, Greg Willett, you may know him or not, and a couple of years ago at Thanksgiving dinner at the hall, he had shot a deer in season, everything was fine, but he left the gut piled. But on his way home, he had to pass a couple cabins of people that lived up there, and he stopped to tell them, because they were joggers. And he said, I just wanted to let you know that there's a gut pile not too far away, so if you're out jogging, you know, because that's what brings the bears and the crows in. So he was being neighborly and telling them, just pay attention to what you're doing. And same story, different time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, if you see the raven sitting in a tree, stay the hell away from there, because there's something big on that gut pile.
Yep. Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
The birds get run off by, well, the interlocal, maybe last summer or the winter before, the Fish and Game said the biggest predator in the North Fork for killing things was the mountain lion. But the mountain lions were starving to death because the wolves or the bear were running them off, so they couldn't benefit from their kill.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought about that.
Yeah. Well, just this last fall, I don't know who killed the moose, but there was a dead moose up Coal Creek, and the grizzly bear and five wolves were fighting over it. The grizzly bear won. I went there afterwards. I waited about a week afterwards. I went there and looked at it. You could see where he covered stuff up,
yep.
But there wasn't any hair, there wasn't any bones or nothing there. Everything was gone.
Yep.